Oh, good evening, everyone. And today I showed up here with nothing on my mind. So I think that makes it a good day for doing questions or for you to give me a topic or something. So we could sit quietly until someone has a question or by practice, meditation, or Buddhism. Something?
A few weeks ago I was here and we talked a little bit about clarity.
Yeah.
Could you just talk about that a little more?
Well, I have no idea what I talked about clarity, so it's just to talk about clarity. The word for this form of meditation is called vipassana. And vipassana literally is just a very simple word in Pali. In Sanskrit it means to see. And V is kind of like an emphatic prefix. So it means, sometimes some people call it clear seeing or seeing in a special way. Or so sometimes in English we call it insight. So clarity involves an ability to see clearly what's going on. And so the clarity is that ability to see where our biases, our desires, our aversions don't get in the way of our clarity of seeing. It doesn't mean that we have to be free of bias and aversion and desire, but rather we need to see it very clearly that those things are there. If we see those things clearly, then there's an opportunity to kind of, in a sense, step out of them, not be in them, and kind of be able to see kind of around them or something, or see what's really going on, see the way in which we're influenced by them. So the clarity means to know what's happening, to see what's happening, to sense what's happening without bias, kind of indirect, very direct. So it usually involves direct seeing. But for that to happen, the mind usually has to be somewhat calm or settled. The mind is very agitated. It's much harder to be clear when the mind is agitated. It's possible, but for most people, it's almost impossible. So people focus then on developing some concentration or calm or stability of the mind. And that stability of the mind then becomes a foundation for being able to see more clearly. And happy to talk more if you have some question about it more. Why did it interest you?
Because I didn't completely understand.
Does this make more sense today? Or?
It does. And then that must relate to the clinging and trying not to cling to those things that might be disturbing or whatever.
Right. The generally, in teachings of the Buddha, early Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism, clarity is not the goal. Because there can be phenomenal experiences of clarity that arise, and then people will latch on to that. Say, well, that's it, or that's enlightenment, or I've arrived, I've finally gotten it, whatever that it might be. And clarity is not the goal. Clarity is one of the means that helps us to become free of clinging. And part of the function of clear seeing is to see clearly how we cling, which is often very difficult for us to see or have aversion. Today I was talking to someone who was anxious about his life and was in a big transition, an upheaval in his life of what to do, and needed to kind of start over again with lots of different things. And he was an older man, and the idea of starting a new profession, a new life, in his elderly life, elderly time, seemed very, he didn't want to do it. And he was old enough to be able to retire, and people are telling him, we should probably retire, you can get a small Social Security pension and all that. And as we explored it together, what was really going on for him was that, So he was tired of kind of finding a career for himself and he didn't have a house to live in, finding housing and stuff. And what he had aversion to was not finding work or finding a place to live, getting his life set up again, what he had aversion to was his anxiety about those things, which are two very different things. And most people, I think, would very quickly kind of identify the object they were anxious about as being the problem. Let's get rid of it. And so his desire to retire was partly, let's get rid of that whole part of my life. But when he could identify that it was the anxiety he had aversion to and not the activity, then he realized the activity could be actually be quite, you know, easy if he could just deal with his anxiety. So the usually it takes some real clear seeing to be able to see that. So the function of clear seeing is to help us flush out the ways in which the subtle ways and the gross ways that we cling. And based on that clinging, we suffer. Because if we want in a healthy way become free of our suffering, we have to really come to terms and learn how to let go of that deep clinging. So the whole focus on developing stability and concentrating on the breath and getting calm and also developing clarity is not for its own sake so much, though it can seem very appealing to do that, but rather so that we can begin seeing more clearly how we tick and how we work, and then have the wisdom to know how to live in a wiser way. Make sense? Please, Anne.
To follow up on that, do you have any advice for dealing with anxiety?
Do you want to say a little bit more about?
Oh, pick a subject. Anxious about anything and everything.
Oh, so anxiety is the common denominator for many areas of your life, the common theme. So it doesn't really matter what the object of anxiety is.
Well, related to that fellow you were talking about, it's the fear of the anxiety that is causing fear of the suffering.
Uh-huh. And what prevents you from trusting life more? Trusting yourself more?
Recent experiences and family training.
There are many ways of, working with anxiety. I mean, in mindfulness, one of the first things we're trying to do is to see it clearly, recognize it, which is not always so easy. Anxiety, there's a kind of way in which we recoil from anxiety, or anxiety can kind of camouflage itself from itself because we can be so outwardly focused. The things of the world, the things we're anxious about. Usually we're anxious about something. And so we're preoccupied with trying to fix that thing or protect ourselves from that thing. And one of the important movements of this kind of meditation practice is a training. We train the attention to turn away from the objects of attention, the object of desire, the object of aversion, the object of anxiety, and turn the attention around, in a sense, into the subjective experience of being anxious, the subjective experience of having aversion, hate, the subjective experience of having desire or fear. And because as long as you're focused on the object, it's very hard to see what's actually going on. And so we kind of learn how to let go of the object, what we're concerned about, and how does it actually feel to have to be a person who's anxious at this very moment. And then to help with that exploration, to really get to know and feel and explore anxiety better, it's really helpful to feel it in your body. Where in my body do I feel anxiety? Worry and anxiety has a lot to do with imaginary thoughts about the future, what things might happen in the future. Some psychologists say anxiety and worry always are imaginary, as opposed to fear, which could be real. And because it's so head-oriented, because imagination has to do with the head, thoughts and ideas, worrying thoughts, to ground it in the body is a way of getting out of the aboutness, what we're anxious about, and begin kind of connecting with the direct immediate experience what we're feeling. And to feel it in your body, feel the tightness or the butterflies in the stomach or the tightness in wherever it might be. And then just to feel and sense it. And in sensing something like that in the body, it's kind of like if we can see it clearly or we can be really present for it, then it's kind of like we get out of its way. We stop fueling it. We start engaging with it reactively. And then just feel it in your body. You feel anxiety and feel a tension in your stomach or in your jaws or whatever it might be. And just like it has permission to be there. Don't be in a hurry to get rid of it. Don't try to do the practice to stop it from being there. Just hold it there. Hold the attention in that area. And what will probably happen is two things. Either the attention will begin to unravel by itself, begin kind of letting go of itself, because the natural tendency for all anxiety and all fear, all hate, all desire, is that it really what it'll do if it's left alone is dissolve. But it doesn't dissolve because we're constantly re-engaging with it and refueling it. So you might just hold your attention there and feel it in your body, and pretty quickly you might get calm and feel a lot better. Or you might not. And if you might not, then the trick, or the part of the practice, is to look at what your relationship is to that anxiety. To clarify, how do you relate to anxiety? When you get anxious, do you run away? Do you escape? Do you lash out at the world around you? Which, you know, different strategies people have when they're anxious. To see how, or do you have aversion to it? Are you pushing it away? Are you trying to deny it? You know, what is the relationship you have to it? What's the resistance? What happens? And start understanding that relationship that you form with anxiety, with the hope that you can learn how to eventually let go of the reactive ways of relating to it and just let the anxiety be there free-floating without a reactive relationship to it. And that's possible. So anxiety doesn't just go away, but you're not troubled by it because you're not so resisting it or reactive to it or judgmental about it, or don't come to great conclusions about what it means that you're anxious. You know, this means that I'm a terrible person and I shouldn't be this way, or it's just anxiety. Part of that investigation is, which some people find helpful, is to depersonalize the anxiety, which means we don't become aloof from it or, you know, disassociated from it. What it means is we simply don't take it as being reflective of some personal quality of who we are. We don't take it as being a definition of ourselves. So rather than becoming my anxiety, it's just anxiety. And it sounds innocent enough to say it's my anxiety because it's yours, not mine. However, when we own it up, we own it by, with the word my, then it tends to bring in a lot of other associated associations, thoughts, ideas, meanings. And then we start to get very nervous about who I am and how I'm being defined. But if you can just let it be anxiety free-floating, not even my anxiety, it's a lot easier to be present for it and see it for what's going on. As you learn to stay present for anxiety, and it's a real art to do that, and it takes a long time to do that, but your job is to get a PhD in anxiety, is to really study it. So don't think there's a shortcut. Don't do a spiritual bypass around it. Really, you have to take it really seriously and really get to know it, sense it and feel it. Look for opportunities. Don't make yourself anxious, but when it arises, study it. Just be really present for it, especially good in meditation time. If you sit down to meditate and you're a little bit anxious, don't meditate in such a way to get rid of the anxiety as quickly as you can to get calm. Meditate so you can develop a real clear sense of seeing what anxiety is. So you could write a dissertation on what it feels like in your body. You can write a dissertation on what your relationship is to it and all the ways in which you kind of, you know, react like a trapped rat, you know, when anxiety is there. And slowly, one of the things you might be able to start noticing is the cognitive elements going on. You start, as you become a little bit freer of the thought process that brings on the worry and anxiety, you might also begin noticing some of the thought patterns that bring on anxiety, some of the belief systems, some of them maybe you've acquired from childhood or from past experiences. We carry with us beliefs, very deep attitudes towards life that are so deep within us that we don't even think they're attitudes. We think that this is the way the world is. Some people have the attitude that the world, people are always threatening. And somehow they've internalized that notion. And doesn't everyone think that? You know, that's what they, you know. Isn't everyone just, you know, thinking that people are threatening, you need to always be on your guard or defensive? Or some people internalize, you know, that the world is a malignant force out there. And, you know, it's all kinds of attitudes we develop inside of us. And it's very hard to see those attitudes. But as we begin getting calmer and settled, and we're able to stay present for anxiety without reacting to it, without running away from it, without doing anything about it, just seeing it and holding it there, you might start becoming a little bit freer of the thoughts, seeing what those thoughts are. And then you can begin either letting go of them or reevaluating, is this really the truth? Is this really the way things are? Is this really what you want to base your life on? And is it really an assumption or hypothesis that you somehow acquired? Is it someone's voice from the distant past that you've held on to and clinging? Sometimes those the cognitive ideas that support worry are clinging to certain ideas about what things should be or how you want people to see you. So I know some people who are anxious because the anxiety is, this is not normal, I mean, that's usual, but in some families, the way to show that you loved someone other than the family was to worry about them. And if you didn't worry, then you weren't loving them, you know. So everyone developed this wonderful ability to communicate worry because that's how you show that. And then it becomes just a habit. You know, worrying is how you show you get, you know, interested in your care. And that's a belief system that gets, you know, deeply ingrained inside of us. And as the mind gets quieter and stiller and more able to be present for anxiety, those cognitive belief systems become highlighted. And then the opportunity is to have a new, to drop them, change your relationship to them, not be tricked by them. Clear seeing doesn't mean you have to get rid of them, but you see them coming. You say, oh, that's just a belief. So, for example, when I was writing my dissertation, I was anxious sometimes. The dissertation was a big deal. And, you know, I had to do those defense, and these big, kind of powerful people had to read it. And, you know, it was a huge, daunting task to do this big dissertation. And periodically, there would be this little voice and anxiety inside of me, this fear. I can't do this. This is too difficult for me, you know. Or I'm not doing a good enough job here. And they're not going to accept it, or they're not going to like me, or, you know, they're not going to invite me to their out for lunch, or whatever. But I had the ability to see those thoughts arise. And I just basically, you know, saw them, they were there. And seeing them in a healthy way, I just, in a sense, ignored them. I kind of just treated them like pesky little flies kind of buzzing around the background. And I didn't let them interfere with what I had to do next. You know, the next word, the next sentence, the next footnote. You know, and I just, because I was so familiar with that process, that level of kind of anxiety, that those kinds of thoughts, that I, you know, just pesky flies. Yeah?
What's the developmental model by which we develop all these attachments and clinging? Is there a way of raising children that to sort of minimize that, or is it something that we all need to unlearn?
Well, I'm confident that there are ways of minimizing it, because as a meditation teacher who talks to a lot of people who come to me, they come with lots of stories about how their way their parents brought them up maximized it. I mean, I feel like I've learned a lot about parenting from listening to other people's stories about how they were parented, and learning the tremendous suffering that can cause, and. You know, but how, you know, to minimize. The Buddhist tradition, I don't know if they know what they're talking about, but the Buddhist tradition says that the source of our clinging, our attachments, our suffering, cannot be found. The original source, the primary source, it has no beginning, it's beginningless. It goes back to beginningless time. You know, the Buddhists believe in rebirth, so it's easy to have this idea, it just goes back to beginningless time. There isn't some the Freudian beginning, this is where it all starts, you know, it's just built into who we are in a sense. Though I shouldn't say it that way, it's not like it's built in who we are, because at the same time, the Buddha said, in a sense, that it says the mind is luminous, except for the defilements that visit it. It's as if the attachments and clinging are visitors, even though they've been visiting since the very beginningless beginning. But they're just visitors, and who we are in our essence, in a sense, is actually free of that anxiety, those attachments. So can you raise children to minimize their, you know, and well, I'm trying to find out myself these days. And what I'm learning is how many attachments I have, is what I'm learning, you know, and hopefully as I learn and recognize my own, that... then I can be more wise about what I model for my child. And so what I'm modeling is hopefully someone who's not so clinging so much. Or if when I do, I have a wise relationship to that, then model a wiser relationship. And I think that counts for a lot. Right now I'm reading a little book about power struggles with kids. And it seems the book is a lot based on Daniel Goldman's book, Emotional Intelligence. And the author says that you can do a very important aspect of raising children in a healthy way is not to teach, is to develop their emotional intelligence. So they can learn to recognize their emotions when they're having it, and they can learn effective ways of dealing with it rather than acting out. And that's been my experience through Buddhist practice, is that a lot of the attachments we have are maladaptive attempts to try to deal with deeper fundamental needs that are better, really, really better dealt with and responded to in other ways besides the attachments that we have. Attachments are often misplaced attempts to get some basic deep sense of well-being, security, happiness, peace that is kind of also maybe inherent in who we are, a desire for that.
So maybe by meeting those needs as much as possible when raising children, it will sort of reduce the misdirection of the attachments.
It would be nice to believe that. I don't know much about child raising. Really, I don't. It's a mystery to me. I struggle with it every day. I shouldn't be speaking. but one, you know, maybe in 18 years I have something to say. But one of the kind of theories that I operate by is that there's no way I'm going to do it right. And all I can do is try to do my best, and the best includes setting it up so that when the child becomes an adult, they have the values, the skills, the understanding, or whatever, that where they can try to figure it out for themselves. They can make they can fix whatever problems I you know created for them. And so maybe every parent you know does it wrong. Maybe it's built into parenting, but you do it right by ensuring somehow that when they become adults, that they have the tools to be able to sort it out. I find some solace with that idea. And the other thing is, from the Buddhist tradition, is the story of the Buddha's life, which is kind of an archetypical story. And it's a story of someone who, as a child, was given everything. Supposedly, you know, also love, and given every possible, you know, thing that a child could do. He was a son of a king and queen, and his mother died when he was 7 years old, which maybe that set it all up for all of us. But he was raised by a loving aunt and the king, and had all these benefits, you know, all these wonderful things happened to him, all this love and support. And even getting the best upbringing that was available, it didn't resolve the issue of suffering and clinging. It might be these things are really, as the saying goes, you know, really comes with being born. It's kind of like as we develop ourselves as individuals, the very development of ourselves as individuals comes with clinging to a sense of self. And maybe that's partly healthy, and that even with a most healthy upbringing from parents and from society around us, there's still some sense of developmental sense of developing a self. And it's really almost natural to then cling to that. And a really important function of Buddhist practice is to train us in the trust that allows us to let go of any clinging to self. So, I don't know. I just talked for a while. I hope it related. Do you want to say more or come back with something else?
Someday.
Do you have kids?
Mm-hmm.
How old?
12 and 14.
You're way ahead of the game to me. Mine's 3 years old. Yes?
It seems to me that you're saying that when you have that sense of clarity and the ability to not be attached, then like all those past assumptions or anxieties or whatever, you're free from all that. But then when you... I'm just curious about your opinion about like therapies that feel like those experiences that make you attached are found in reside in your tissues or somehow in your body, and you need to have some sort of like traumatic or epiphanic epiphany or some sort of like dramatic release of that, to actually release yourself of those attachments.
Uh-huh.
Like, what's your view is on that, like primal therapy, or do you know anything about that?
I know a little bit about primal therapy from a long time ago. That's it probably has developed in 20 years since I knew anything about it, because most things develop through time, the thinking. In the 70s, in the 60s and late 60s and 70s, there was a very powerful trend in the world of psychotherapy and humanistic psychology to emphasize catharsis, deep release of things. And most therapists coming in the mid-80s and the 90s began feeling that was over-emphasized. And then, in fact, by focusing too much on catharsis and release of the emotion, there was often a reinforcement of the very tendency to have those emotions. There'd be a sense of relief at the time. You express your anger, get it all off your chest. But the expression of the anger actually reinforced the tendency to get angry in the future with some people. And so nowadays, I think it's not quite as popular anymore as it had been in the 70s to do this kind of primal scream or release or catharsis and all that. For some people, the kind of experience is very useful, very important. And you see that in meditation even. Sometimes people are sitting in meditation and on retreat, for example, and sometimes very deep releases occur spontaneously, in a sense, as we begin letting go of the surface way in which we hold ourselves together. And so sometimes there's not unusual on retreat for some people to cry, sometimes for days on end. You know, they never cried in their life, for example, and they're just crying and crying, and they just have to cry for a long time until something's been released and let go of. Sometimes you sit in meditation and overwhelming sense of anger arises. And as a teacher, I encourage people to just get out of the way, and at least sitting there in meditation, just let it course through you. Don't act on it, don't release it, but let it course through you. Some people who are very repressed and just completely not in touch with their emotions, it can be useful to do a kind of cathartic kind of exercises in order for them to kind of get in touch with them, get a sense of what they are. And so sometimes it's useful to kind of evoke those kinds of things. What the Buddhist tradition kind of says is that maybe I said enough. is that enough of an answer, or ask it again, or from a different angle?
I guess I wonder actually what your personal belief is on that sort of experience.
Well, I'd rather not have a belief, a view, because it's really an individual matter. And so I think it's really, rather than carrying around the view, it's a matter of talking to an individual directly or sensing them directly what's going on, and to get a sense of what is appropriate for that particular person. And for certain individuals, it might be useful to have catharsis. And certain individuals have dramatic, it's quite dramatic, the releases that might happen. And other individuals never have that, and it's not even appropriate for them to have it. Some people having the dramatic releases is not useful. There's a relief that can come with it, but it's not useful. Some people, it's very useful. So it's really a case-by-case basis. And I'd rather not have, a view. Yeah?
A follow-up question on the anxiety discussion before, what you said. It seems that, as you said, you focus on the anxiety feelings, then that can dissipate the anxiety itself.
Sometimes, unless you get more anxious.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm wondering is if you... it seems that the way I would look at it is if you're focusing on the anxiety, you're not focusing on the cause of the anxiety. So if I go back and if I focus on the cause, then I'm going to be more anxious probably, because that's the thing that's stirring it up. So is that the correct understanding? I mean, if you just focus on feelings, in a way you're bringing yourself into the present moment.
Right.
And you're not thinking about things out there.
In the future, yeah, exactly. And with the opportunity to get, as you focus on your bodily feeling, what's happening in the present, and just be with that, usually you'll get more ease. But the important thing is that as you get more stable and more calm and more present, then you can begin investigating what the true cause is. And the true cause is not the speech you're going to give next week. You say, well, you know, I'm going to stop focusing on speech because then, you know, I'll just get more anxious again. But that's not really the cause. That's a condition for the arising of anxiety. The cause might actually be a subtle belief that it's important what people think about you. And so, but that belief system is operating in the present moment. It isn't operating in the future, it's happening right now. And the reason you're getting the cause for the anxiety is the present moment existence of that concern about what people think about you. And as you get more calm and stable and able to let go of thinking about the speech next week, then you might be able to see the more immediate cause right now. And as you see the immediate cause, that might give you kind of the clue to see how anxiety works in all kinds of other arenas. Because often there's a common denominator that works in many different areas. And the concern, for example, of how people are going to think about you might operate in other areas of your life besides just a speech. And so, am I making sense?
Yeah.
Well, what if, that's a very good point that you raised, because I have too have been having trouble with anxiety, and I tried doing just what you said, which was to sit calmly and feel it in my body. And I made it so bad that I ended up in a full-fledged panic attack. So I'm a little confused.
Right. Yes. So it'd be nice to be able to kind of give, you know, a single prescription that, you know, for different situations, that this, do this and everything will be, you know, better. However, yeah, we have to kind of try various things and see what the results are within us. And it's not uncommon for people to focus on anxiety and get more anxious. And then it can be, sometimes it's just counterproductive. It's not helpful at all to do that. Sometimes it isn't productive to get more anxious. Because only by getting more anxious can you really begin seeing clearly what's going on in an underlying deep structural way. And so you have to have the wisdom to know when it's useful to kind of go into it and get more anxious, and when getting more anxious, just getting a panic attack is probably not useful. So then if you have a sense that going into the anxiety and being present for it is not useful for you, then you want to develop some other skills. And perhaps what you want to do is focus on just developing breath meditation and learn how to use the breath as a calming device. So rather than focusing on the sensations of anxiety in your body, you just focus on the breath. Stay with the breath. If the breath is calming. If the breath is not... Just back off. And if the breath is, back off, not enough, drop back off completely. Forget about that anxiety. I'm anxious, but I'm just not going to look at that. I'm just going to ignore it for the time being and just focus on the breath or listen to sounds or there's all kinds of other meditation ways. Do loving kindness meditation, for example. And then that brings a sense of stability and sense of well-being and calm. And once that's there, it might be possible then to turn around and look at the anxiety and just kind of poke around it a little bit. And then if you feel like it's getting out of hand, then come back again to that stability. Yes.
Somehow I just had a vision as you finished saying that of, sometimes there's anxiety when it's literally emergency situation. Pretty good reason to be anxious. But then I think how many times I've watched firemen and first aid and ambulance people. They move very deliberately. They're trained. They know that to move too fast, they'll make a mistake. They only let themselves go just so fast. And you're thinking, why don't they hurry, but odds are they'll mess something up. It's kind of interesting comparison. There's only so much good the anxiety will do, even an emergency.
And maybe it doesn't do any good.
Yeah.
It can. Anxiety can be very compelling. It has kind of compelling voice. It says, we get tricked into it, seduced by it. But maybe it has no real important role. And so maybe even in emergencies. Yes.
Well, when you brought up doing the loving kindness meditation, it made me think about listening to a tape a little while back, a talk by Pema Chodron. She was talking about compassion and being able to transfer whatever difficulty you're having to being compassionate for that same difficulty that other people might be having. Can you talk about that?
Let me see if I followed you. Pema Chodron said that when you're having some difficulty yourself, kind of imagine all the other people in the world having the same difficulty, and then develop compassion for the people in the world who have this difficulty, and for yourself. And that's one of the ways of changing your relationship to it, so you're not caught up and enmeshed in it, but see it in an open, generous way. And whether you do that through loving kindness or through compassion or through clear seeing, we're trying to develop a new relationship with our difficulties, so we're not enmeshed with it and seduced by it or caught by it. And compassion is really one of the, really, you know, there's three powerful meditation practices in my book. There's the meditation of mindfulness, of clear seeing, loving kindness, and compassion. And in different circumstances, you might want to use different ones of those. And what Pema Chodron teaches is very, very effective for some people. And I would say that most people in our society could use a lot more self-compassion. And it usually what comes anyway with practice, whether you want it or not, is compassion and self-compassion. It's just a very important quality. And what we're looking for ultimately is not enlightenment, but compassionment. To become more compassionate people. Yeah.
Would you please speak more to this topic of self-compassion, need for self-compassion? Forgive me if that is at first a very positive.
Maybe it's the last sentence.
Forgive me if the concept of self-compassion seems at first puzzling to me. I do not understand it. That's why I'm asking you. Please speak more to what and why.
Compassion is what the Latin roots of the word means. Com means with, and passion originally one of the meanings of suffering, to suffer with, kind of like empathy. And the ability to be present for suffering and kind of in some way feel its presence, to feel connected to it, to feel empathy for it, to feel compassion for it, is a very important human quality. And some people don't have much of it for various reasons, but it's a very important human quality to feel someone else's suffering. But in Buddhism, compassion is more than just empathy, which is kind of, in some sense, intuiting or feeling the other person suffering, or feeling, imagining yourself in their shoes, or imagine themselves as yourself as them. Compassion in Buddhist sense also is empathy plus the desire within you for their well-being, that they be freed of their suffering. Compassion doesn't arise in the abstract. It isn't like you're just, you know, it's a good idea to be compassionate, so I'm going to walk around compassionate. Compassion arises when we're in contact with suffering. So it's a beautiful virtue. It's a wonderful thing, compassion. But it's messy because, and it's painful because it only arises in a real way when we're in touch with suffering in the world, whether it's our own or the world around us. And most people, maybe as you, associate compassion with what we feel towards others. Or some people can only feel it towards animals, you know, whatever. But we're just a human being like anyone else. And we suffer like anybody else. And to be fully present for our own suffering in a clear way, without obstruction, elicits the same kind of response in our own heart as the suffering of someone else as when we're present for theirs. We can feel kind of empathy. We can feel kind of tenderness, a kind of quivering, a kind of desire for our own well-being, a kind of care, a kind of acceptance for ourselves and our suffering, the difficulty of being a human being. Many people in the West, there's kind of a perfectionist trend in the West that you have to be. People need to be perfect. Shouldn't make any mistakes, and. And it's very hard, for most people to get along in our modern life. For example, people in Silicon Valley, in California, especially around here, probably have to make more decisions in their life on a daily basis than most human beings have ever had to do in their whole life. tremendous amount of decision making, because usually you're born into a clan, into a village, into a tribe, and it was obvious what you were supposed to do. Your parents were farmers, you were a farmer. You know, it was just kind of felt preordained, this is the way it was, and you don't have to have all this anxiety about your career choice and who you're going to work for. You have to decide, you know, whether it was going to be, you know, rye or wheat or cassava or yams, you know. And then we have this very strong strand in the America of individualism, that we have to be individuals, we have to kind of stand on our own, and it lends to tremendous alienation and a lot of difficulties. I mean, I was struck reading this morning's paper of Steiner, the guy who killed the three women in Yosemite. He in his confession, he said something like, "It was the first time I felt like I was in charge." You know, my whole life was, you know, when he was murdering these three women. Timothy McVeigh quoting the poem that says, "I'm the master of my own soul." It's kind of a warping of extension of American individualism, which lends to a kind of tremendous alienation and sense of hopelessness for a lot of people. At the same time, being told that, you know, you have to be individual and stand on your own two feet and not depend on other people. And so there's a lot of suffering that people here in the West feel. And that there's a perfectionist strand that you have to be perfect and succeed and manage. And what's most useful, I think, is to have some sense of compassion for oneself and the difficulty of living in our society, from being who we are. Not as a way of condoning what was going on, not to kind of get, you know, to become the victim of it, you know, and have people feel sorry for you or feel sorry for yourself. Feeling sorry for is not the same thing as compassion, but rather in order to not be critical or judgmental, not to be harsh or closed or numb to that suffering, but rather have a wise, loving relationship to oneself and to the world around. Does this make any sense? No, not at all, huh? Think. Yes.
Many of us are probably here with the goal of reducing our attachment. And it seems possible to get sort of attached to that goal. And I personally sort of struggle with the distinction between sort of goals and achievements. I mean, we can obviously overdo on being achievement-oriented, but yet it still seems like there's some basic values that you can decide you want to pursue in a way, or try or explore, such as reducing your attachments. But where do you draw the line, or how do you sort of distinguish between those things? Is it bad to have goals? Is it bad to want to achieve something? Why bother getting up in the morning at all? It's sort of an academic argument. I never feel that way myself.
Oh, I see.
What's a good, reasonable motivation for doing things? Yourself, other people? Life is great. I mean, I don't.
Oh, you're asking huge questions now. I wish you'd ask just one at a time. The world of Buddhist teachings has a great diversity of teachings about goals and non-goals and all kinds of things. So you find a great wealth and variety and conflicting teachings about this topic. So, however, if you get my point of view, goals are inherent in human life. When it's time to go to the bathroom, we have a goal to get to the bathroom in time, and then to release. And I didn't realize this until quite recently, that I knew there was a whole skill in holding it in, that, you know, had to be developed. It's not so obvious, right? I mean, these little kids have to be, he's finally sleeping through the night and he has a dry diaper. Wow, he learned how to do it. You know, you can hold it in. It's a great step forward. Parents are really happy with that. But it seems that there's a whole other skill that I didn't realize it was a skill you have to learn, and knowing then how to release it on will, out of choice. Because my poor son, you know, he sits there on the potty and nothing's happening. And the last thing he wants to do is sit there until something happens. You know, he's not that patient. And so it's a whole skill in letting go. So why am I saying this? So goals.
Our daily goals.
Our daily goals. So we have these goals, you know, getting to the bathroom in time, you know, is a goal. You know, if you're laying in bed, why get out of bed? Pretty soon your bladder will tell you why. And so goals in themselves are not a problem. The problem is our clinging to goals or our resistance sometimes to having goals. And so what we're trying to do is have a wise relationship to them, that there's no clinging involved. And now there's a paradox with practice that some Buddhist teachers will point out, that if the goal is to be without clinging, then the desire to be without clinging seems to go against that. It doesn't quite, so it sounds that way. You know, if the desire is to be without, if the goal is to be without desire, then you can't have a desire for non-desire. But that's a little bit kind of false use of language to come up with this kind of simplistic logic like that. The goal is not to cling. It's possible to have a healthy desire for not clinging that doesn't involve clinging itself. Just like you can have a desire to go to pee when you're, you know, it's okay with you to pee in your pants, but it seems healthy enough to, you know, it's not your carpet here, so it seems like a good idea to get up and go, and there's no clinging involved, it just makes good sense. So there could be, if the goal is to be free of clinging, if the goal is not to be free of desire, if the goal is to be free of clinging, there can be a healthy desire for that freedom. But there can be clinging to it. And that's what we have to be in lookout sometimes, to pay attention to if the motivation for our practice is involves some kind of attachment. The demand, the need, the expectation that something be a certain way. So some Buddhist teachers focus on not having any goals when you practice, being goalless, because they're really trying to stress that the spirit in which you do the practice can't have any clinging as part of it. There has to be a kind of open, allowing things to be as they are. So how you negotiate that is up to you, but mindfulness is supposed to be self-correcting. You're supposed to bring your attention back periodically and to pay attention to the way in which you're practicing, the way in which you're living your life, and is there clinging as part of it in your motivation, in what you're trying to do. And probably there will be in terms of like Buddhist meditation practice. And as your practice gets deeper and deeper, it flushes out the more and more subtle attachments that are built into the way in which we practice. You don't have to be in a hurry to get those out. You know, you don't have to be ahead of the game. But in the right time, the deeper, more subtle attachments will be revealed, and then you can let go of them. Does that address your concern?
Yeah, it helps a lot, but basically life can be full of healthy desires.
Oh, sure, desire is not a problem.
Yeah.
Desires are like a dime a dozen. They're really easy to have. How do you relate to your desires is the question Buddhism asks. Not do you have them or don't have them, how do you relate to them? And if you see them a dime a dozen, you know, they can come and go as they wish, great. But if every desire, you know, comes along with this compulsion, this is the one that I have to act on, it has to be this way, then you're going to suffer. Is that enough? Now that we have no more goals and desires, let's end with a sitting.